Great pleasure to welcome Mark Rubinstein for another conversation about his terrific weekly newsletter, Net Interest, in which he discusses financial sector themes. We're going to talk about Wells Fargo's rehabilitation, Mark. I guess we're starting with the quarter that the large banks in the US reported that came in better than most had expected.
Yeah, that's right. Hi, John. So actually, it always fascinates me how quickly banks, which are huge, sprawling organizations, are able to come to the market and update the market with their quarterly numbers. Typically, they're the first cohort of large companies to report at the end of the quarter. And sure enough, 14th of April, JP Morgan reported Wells Fargo as well. And over the course of that week, we had all the large US banks report their earnings for the first quarter 2021. And what a quarter it was! It was a very strange quarter. It was at the same time very active in the capital markets, but it was also very positive from a credit perspective, certainly compared to 2020, when banks were forced to take additional provisions against potential credit losses. Overall, it looks like it may have been the best single quarter that this group of banks has ever reported.
And that's quite astonishing considering some of the expectations that, let's say, JP Morgan had for where unemployment would still be in Q1 and what that would mean for reserves.
Well, that's right. I wrote a piece, John, last year in July of 2020 on a new accounting standard called CECL. And CECL was introduced, CECL was introduced as a new accounting standard under US GAAP at the beginning of 2020. It was quite unfortunate timing. It related to provisioning and the way banks would henceforth be required to provision against potential loan losses. And the timing was unfortunate because clearly, not 3 months after the introduction of this new rule, we had a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of the way the economy would pan out. The nuts and bolts of this new accounting standard are simply that, rather than taking provisions against incurred losses, provisions would be taken against expected future losses. So if you like, it's a kind of a mark to market of the loan book in the way that securities portfolios would be marked to market. From the 1st of January 2020, loans would kind of have to be marked to market as well, to the extent that they are able to capture credit risk. Clearly, when the pandemic hit, economic assumptions, which feed into the models which determine the credit losses that need to be the credit loss provisions that need to be put aside. When the pandemic hit, there was a huge amount of uncertainty as to how those loans would perform. And what banks were forced to do is a number of different economic models, and they would take a weighted average. They basically look at a number of alternative future trajectories, and take a weighted average across them all. Now, back in March 2020, and then subsequently in June 2020 as well, actually, they were forced to take even higher provisions in the second quarter of last year when the full extent of the pandemic was more available to them. Remember, lockdowns only began in kind of March of 2020. So when they closed their books at the end of March 2020, they didn't have full information at that stage, but they were forced to take huge provisions. Back a year ago, JP Morgan assumed that, where are we now? We're in April 2021. They assumed that by April 2021, the unemployment rate would be 9%. Actually, that was off the peak. They assumed it would peak a lot higher than that, but would be beyond the worst come April 2021, would be at 9% unemployment. In actual fact, we're at 6% unemployment. So economic development hasn't been as bad as JP Morgan anticipated, for a whole host of reasons that listeners will be familiar with. And as a result, all of those provisions they took last year, and they took an additional just over $12 billion of provisions, they could write those back. So in Q1 of 2021, they wrote back just over $5 billion of those $12 billion of provisions. They've still got $7 billion in their back pocket. And the reason for that, and actually it's unclear whether all of that will come back, because if you think about a range of possible futures, the probability that people going forward will put on a kind of a pandemic scenario is likely to be higher than it ever was pre-January 2020. And even if it's a 1%, a 5% probability, the severity associated with it is sufficiently high that it requires provisions to be put aside against it. So it's not clear all of those $7 billion will come back, but certainly in Q1 of this year, we had $5 billion out of $12 billion coming back, and that padded the profits of JP Morgan and all the other banks that reported over the course of that period.
Well, interestingly, balance sheets have gotten stronger, not weaker, in the pandemic, and deposits have been very strong, but loan growth has not been.
Yeah, very, very interesting scenario, actually. So deposits, bank deposits, this is system-wide bank deposits in the United States, have increased from the end of 2019 by $3.4 trillion. Absolutely phenomenal number. And those incremental deposits come from a range of sources. They come from companies, certainly in the early stages of the pandemic, drawing down on their credit lines for emergency use, and therefore depositing those draws in bank accounts. They come from consumers who have enjoyed the benefits of stimulus. They've received stimulus checks. In some cases, those checks have been spent, but in other cases, they are sitting in bank accounts. Other sources. So lots of sources. Companies were more cautious and therefore were retaining liquidity. And although clearly there's been an impact from excess liquidity in markets, we've seen many examples of kind of strange behavior in markets, actually, in the first quarter of 2021. GameStop is one example. Many other examples as well. Crypto, for example. In spite of that, a lot of these deposits still remain as deposits on banks' balance sheets. Now, QE, actually, the one point I didn't mention was QE. QE, massive, massive impact. A lot of the proceeds from the securities that are being bought by the Fed are ending up back on banks' balance sheets in deposits. So whether it's corporate deposits via the draw of credit lines, whether it's consumer deposits through stimulus checks, or whether it's kind of institutional deposits as a result of QE, all of it has fattened banks' balance sheets system-wide by over $3 trillion. Now, you mentioned loan growth. Historically, there's been a kind of a correlation between deposit growth and loan growth, particularly in the United States, where, unlike in some emerging markets, where there are reserve requirements, and for every $10 of deposits, maybe $1, $2 would have to be retained in a reserve requirement. That wasn't the case. That isn't the case in the United States. And as a result, the correlation between loan growth and deposit growth has historically been quite tight. What we've seen over the course of the past year is we've seen deposit growth, which has been immense, as discussed, but loan growth has actually gone backwards. So JP Morgan's loan book contracted by 4%. Other banks contracted by between 4 and 8% since the end of 2019. And that's changed the whole shape of their balance sheet. So the balance sheet, very simplistically, very stylistically, kind of loans on the asset side and securities, and then deposits and other funding sources on the liability side of the balance sheet. And JP Morgan, to use them as the example, their loan to deposit ratio, went from 64% at the end of 2019 to 44%. So, which is actually quite staggering. 44% loan to deposit ratio is kind of like a savings bank of old, kind of a savings bank of old that didn't do much lending. And that's where JP Morgan's loan to deposit ratio currently is.
Right. And there is a weird, I guess, regulatory requirement called the supplementary leverage ratio that JP Morgan has spoken out against, that forces banks to have more capital simply because more deposits are coming in.
That's right. So the supplementary leverage ratio, one of the new ratios, one of the new regulatory tools that was introduced post the financial crisis. Now, Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan has railed against many of these devices that are being employed by regulators. In fact, his shareholder letter was released a week before they reported their first quarter earnings, and listeners could do worse than go and read it, because in fact, Warren Buffett has tipped it historically as one of the best CEO letters that he certainly values. And in previous years, and again in this year, he's railed against some of these regulations. And the issue here is that these incremental deposits have to have capital lodged against them. And that makes them expensive for banks to hold. The argument is it wouldn't be natural to turn deposits away. And historically, investors that have looked at banks have often valued them on the basis of their deposits. Deposits are equivalent to the kind of float, particularly in the case of many banks where they are interest-free, they're non-interest-bearing deposits. They're a kind of a float. Not only right now is the value of that float much lower because of low interest rates, but in addition, if banks are forced to put capital against them in order to meet these new supplementary leverage ratio requirements, then the profitability becomes really very, very low. But nevertheless, it's an issue. The Fed actually, for a period over the pandemic, gave banks some reprieve. They suspended that requirement for a temporary period of time. There was some speculation they would extend that reprieve, but they did not. And so as a result, JP Morgan is now bound, as are several other banks, by this requirement. And just to throw some numbers out there, the leverage ratio requirement is 5%. JP Morgan was with the reprieve, actually, it was above 6%. But once that was taken away, it's back to 5.5%. So there's kind of 0.5%, 50 basis points of headroom against this leverage ratio, which means that it really has to be very, very careful on the extent to which it grows its balance sheet from here. Or the flip side is it raises capital. It's been doing a bit of preferred shared issuance. It may have to certainly monitor its buyback activities very, very closely.
Coming to Wells Fargo, it hasn't been in the same predicament as JP Morgan and Bank of America, largely due to a Federal Reserve consent order that was handed down in February 2018.
Right. So this is interesting. This is where it gets interesting. One of the issues of regulation, in my view, is that of unintended consequences. Regulatory rules. So, for example, when the supplementary leverage ratio was introduced, nobody anticipated that the banking system could ever attract $3 trillion of deposits over a kind of 15-month period. And it happened. Wells Fargo, and we can go into the details in a second, but Wells Fargo was handed down a consent order, as you said, John, in 2018, which prohibited them, quite unprecedented actually, for a bank of its scale, prohibited them from growing. They had, for until they rectified some issues, and as I say, we'll talk about what those issues are in a second, they were not allowed to grow their balance sheet any larger than where it was at the end of 2017. And what that meant is that when the pandemic hit and all of these deposits kind of flooded into the banking system, they couldn't take them. Now, the flip side is that actually put a lot more pressure on JP Morgan and Bank of America. So to give you some numbers, JP Morgan grew their deposits by nearly three quarters of $1 trillion, Bank of America by $500 billion, Wells Fargo grew a bit because it was able to lose some other assets elsewhere, but only $100 billion. So kind of $100 billion in deposit growth compared with 720, JP Morgan, 450, case of Bank of America. Huge, huge difference. What that means, and so a number of issues here. So firstly, what that means is they're not constrained by this leverage ratio. They're fine. They've got this similar, they've actually got a better leverage ratio now than they had at the end of 2017. So their balance sheet hasn't grown. They've accumulated capital in the meantime. So they're not constrained by that. And what that means is that when the consent order is removed, which it's an open question when that's going to be, but it's been in place now for more than three years. And Wells Fargo has ticked a couple of the boxes required to have it removed. So that could happen quite soon. It gives them a business opportunity. It gives them an opportunity to go into the market and do business at a more aggressive rate compared to what they've been allowed to over the past few years. Now, next question is, why did they get this consent order? And listeners will remember there was a scandal back in 2016. It emerged in 2016. Wells Fargo was opening unauthorized accounts on behalf of its customers. A culture had invaded Wells Fargo whereby in order to improve its cross-selling rates, and in fact, in 2014, Wells Fargo hosted a big investor day in which they boasted of their phenomenal cross-selling expertise and gave the market and investors who are present some examples of the numbers of products they were selling per customer and what the profit outcomes could be, all of which made perfect sense. But when translating that grand strategy into a incentive plan for employees, something broke down. And just as an aside, whatever grand strategy one looks at, the turning a strategy into a system, particularly across a huge organization, such as a big bank like Wells Fargo, is riddled with difficulty. And there's a trade-off between simplicity and unintended consequences. And in this case, simplicity was that they introduced an incentive plan to branch staff, whereby the more accounts they opened, the more product they sold to existing customers, ultimately something like 15% of their annual remuneration would come in kind of a bonus to reward them for that. And the problem is, and there's an old story about cobras in India. There's a story actually Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan presented in his shareholder letter this year about rats in Vietnam, that in both cases, there was a plague of snakes. There was a plague of rats in a particular town in Vietnam, to dwell on Jamie Dimon's analogy. And the rule, and so an incentive was created that for every dead rat, the person who was able to prove that by delivering the tail of the rat to the relevant authority would get paid. And in both cases had the adverse effect that what happened was people who are inordinately creative, they bred snakes in the case of India, they bred rats in the case of Vietnam, in this particular town of Vietnam, and actually the problem got worse. And a similar thing happened at Wells Fargo, that accounts, in the end, 3.5 million accounts were opened that just shouldn't have been opened. And Wells Fargo was reprimanded for it. Interestingly, very little financial fallout for Wells Fargo. There were various fines, but very little financial. The reputational damage there was huge. And this came at a time anyway when regulators, policymakers were very negative on banks. There's another takeaway, and then I'll pause for breath. There's another takeaway here, which is that typically there are so many risks involved in banking. Typically, we focus on credit risk. We focus on market risk. You know, I wrote last week about Credit Suisse and some of the market risk issues that they've confronted. Credit risk, obviously, very, very prevalent when looking at banking. But there are other risks as well. Reputation is very important, and non-financial kind of operating risks are very important. Wells Fargo maybe got complacent because it survived the financial crisis, and as a result, maybe dwelt too much on credit risk, congratulating itself for having avoided the worst of the credit risk, and then didn't pay enough attention to some of these non-financial risks. So that's what happened in 2016. It didn't actually go away. There was various turnover of management. And in 2017, a report was filed. In 2018, the Fed then came in and said, look, enough's enough. And they put this in consent order in place.
A new CEO has been in place since, I believe, October 2019, Charlie Scharf. What's been his focus since joining the bank?
Well, Charlie Scharf's a great guy. Charlie Scharf actually worked with Jamie Dimon at Bank One, actually prior to that, but also at Bank One. And then he worked with him at Citi, worked with him at Bank One. Then he worked with him at JP Morgan. He then went to Visa. He was chief executive of Visa for a while, also Bank of New York. And then eventually he turns up at Wells Fargo. Great pedigree. He has made a point of changing the culture of Wells Fargo. If you read his shareholder letter, it's not as lyrical as Jamie Dimon's, but it's worth reading specifically in the way it addresses this particular issue. But he talks about the culture. He talks about changing the structure, the management structure, the organizational structure of Wells Fargo. He came in at the end of 2019. He 4 months in, he wrote a shareholder letter in 2020, but in April of this year, he writes another one, and he says, or February of this year, actually, he writes another one, and he says, actually, the situation was worse than he anticipated when he wrote his letter the prior year. So situation was a lot worse. The kind of cultural malaise at Wells Fargo was a lot worse than he anticipated, but he lays out various plans and how he's dealing with that. He's brought in new management. He has changed the operating structure, made it more centralized, a little less decentralized. Changed the sales culture, clearly changed the incentive system. And it looks like he's making progress. So the Q1 results for Wells Fargo are pretty good. He has a cost plan in place. And in the meantime, they've built up quite some capital. So very, very interesting to see what happens. Janet Yellen was actually chair of the Federal Reserve when the consent order came down. She's now obviously at the Treasury in a different role. It'll be interesting to see what happens to Wells Fargo. It's been a good performer, actually. It's been one of the best performers. It's been probably the best performer, certainly of the large banks year to date. So some of this is already in the price, but it'll be interesting to see what happens strategically under this new CEO when those shackles are removed.
Absolutely. So the unintended consequence of that consent order seems like now is giving Wells Fargo more flexibility to grow than some of the other large banks in the U.S. Have at the moment.
Exactly.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for another fascinating discussion. Goodbye for now.
Thanks, John.